www.redcottageinc.org.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
And we'll be going to Radio Chatskill. Hang on one moment. Live from WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill, and I'm your host, Barb Demarest. On the third week of the month on Radio Chatskill, we go here and there in the listening area, looking at some places to go and things to do. We'll check on Eagle Day happening today at the Wall and Paw Pack Environmental Center, and we'll take a ride around Neversink to check out the barn quilts. Finally, we'll climb up to the Gunks and visit the hamlet of Cragsmoor. But first, the news from National Public Radio. Stick around.
EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, in which Trump was loudly asking about a request for Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Biden and his son. The work of House impeachment investigators continues today, and NPR's Windsor Johnson reports.
Mark Sandy would be the first employee of the White House Office of Management and Budget to cooperate with House investigators. Congressional Democrats had requested testimony from other OMB staffers, but they all declined to appear, citing orders from the White House Counsel's office. Sandy is expected to be questioned about the agency's role in withholding nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine. President Trump is accused of using that aid as leverage to press the Ukrainian leader to investigate a political rival. The House will resume public hearings in its investigation on Tuesday. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Louisiana voters are deciding whether to give their incumbent Democratic governor a second term. More from NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards faces Republican businessman Eddie Rasponi, a political newcomer. President Trump has made three visits to Louisiana in hopes of unseating the Democrat.
You got to vote on Saturday. It's a close one, and you're going to have a great Republican governor.
Rasponi has campaigned largely as Trump's man in Louisiana.
We can turn Louisiana around and then support our president in 2020.
Edwards, in turn, says the Republican Rasponi's campaign lacks substance.
Obviously, he's trying to nationalize this race because that's the only shot he has.
Edwards is the only sitting Democratic governor in the Deep South. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
At least five protesters have been killed in Bolivia in a confrontation with security forces. NPR's Philip Reeves has the latest.
These killings are sharply raising tensions in a country already polarized and unstable in the aftermath of the fall of President Evo Morales nearly a week ago. They happened when a crowd of coca farmers tried to cross a bridge near the city of Cochabamba. They were on their way to a protest against the new government. Demonstrators say police opened fire on them as they approached a checkpoint. The local police chief says farmers shot at his forces. Morales, who's in Mexico, is calling this a massacre. There's a furious reaction from his supporters who are demanding an investigation. This is piling more pressure on the inexperienced right-wing interim president, Yanine Añez, who's tasked with leading Bolivia to new elections. Flip Reeves, NPR News, La Paz.
In Paris, a planned march by France's yellow vest protesters has been canceled. Authorities blame violent activists who they say infiltrate marches to fight with police. This is NPR News in Washington. President Trump has issued a full pardon for a former U.S. Army commando charged with murder. The former Green Beret is accused of killing a suspected bomb maker. Trump also pardoned a former Army lieutenant convicted of murder for ordering his men to fire upon three Afghans, killing two. The president also ordered a promotion for a decorated Navy SEAL convicted of posing with a dead Islamic State captive in Iraq. Polls have closed in Sri Lanka's presidential election, with results expected tomorrow night at the earliest. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more.
Gunmen opened fire at buses carrying Muslim voters to a polling station in the north of the island. Activists from the country's Buddhist majority also burned tires in the street. Police are investigating these incidents as possible efforts to stifle minority votes. Sri Lanka's Muslims, about 10% of the population here, have come under attack after Islamist suicide bombers killed more than 250 people last Easter. The most famous candidate, former Defense Secretary Gotabaya Rajapaksa, promises to overhaul national security. But he's been dogged by allegations of human rights abuses that date back a decade to the end of Sri Lanka's civil war. His main rival, Sajit Premadasa, promises to protect minorities and help the poor. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Tangal, Sri Lanka.
Defensive end Miles Garrett of the Cleveland Browns has been suspended for at least the rest of the regular season and postseason by the NFL for swinging a helmet and striking Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Mason Rudolph in the head. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Welcome back to Here and There on WJFF's Radio Chatskill. I'm Barb Demarest. One of the most spectacular features of the region is the raptor population that you see, particularly near the rivers and some of the bigger lakes and ponds. But did you know there's a growing population of golden eagles in the area? The Delaware Highlands Conservancy is having its Eagle Day today in Hawley, and it's a chance to learn more about all sorts of raptors. Let's check in to see what's going on.
My name is Kate Hausman, and I am the Education and Volunteer Coordinator with the Delaware Highlands Conservancy.
And Kate, you've got an event coming up today for Eagle Day, is that correct?
Yes, our event is Eagle Day, and it is at the Wallenpaupack Environmental Learning Center. It's a free event, so there's no registration required. It runs from 12 to 3:30, and there's different kinds of programming going on throughout the day, all focused on eagles in our region.
Now, that environmental center is located by the dam for Lake Wallenpaupack, right near Route 6?
Yeah, the address is 126 Lambert Lane in Hawley.
So a little bit to the south of the town of Hawley, out
Correct.
By the dam.
The entrance to the Environmental Learning Center, there's a big sign out front for it.
Excellent. So what's going on at the Eagle Day event?
So the event is a partnership between our organization, the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, the National Park Service Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, and the Delaware Otsego Audubon Society. So there's different presentations. There's going to be a presentation by Margaret DiBenedetto from the Audubon Society in regard to golden eagles in New York State. And there's going to be live bird presentations by Bill Streeter of the Delaware Valley Raptor Center. So he has a really great collection of live animals that he comes out with. And the National Park Service is going to be sponsoring children's activities throughout the day.
Is it really kind of aimed at families? Is that the audience that you're anticipating?
You know, it's something that has a little bit for everybody. If you're curious about wildlife in our area, if you're interested in learning more about eagles in general, we also have the opportunity for people who are interested in becoming volunteers with our organization, the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. We have an Eagle Watch program that runs throughout the entire winter. So it's an opportunity to connect in regard with learning just more about this wildlife in our area.
And you said Margaret DiBenedetto is going to be doing a presentation on golden eagles?
Yes.
And how are golden eagles different than the bald eagles that we're used to around here?
Biologically, they're very similar. You know, there are some differences in size, but otherwise, you know, the average person from a distance, they're visually very hard to distinguish. So that's actually one of the things that she will focus on is how they are different and what makes them special, because they are a little bit less common in this region.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't see them, or well, maybe you don't realize when you see them, but you don't hear about
exactly,
them a lot
so
in this area.
The juvenile of the bald eagle looks remarkably similar to the golden eagle.
Oh, okay. Is she going to be bringing any golden eagles or just photography?
No, she does not have any live birds as part of her presentation, but she does have a very, very good video, like slideshow presentation.
Oh, I see. What's the involvement of Delaware Highlands Conservancy with eagles?
So we have an Eagle Watch program that runs throughout the winter from January until the beginning of March. We have programming that is either a guided eagle bus tour. We offer four of those tours throughout the winter. We also have volunteers that throughout that whole season are out at eagle viewing blinds. That happens during the weekend, but people are welcome to go really at any time. So we basically are providing information and resources for people who are interested in going out and viewing eagles to either do that independently, to go visit one of our volunteer-staffed blinds, or to attend one of the Eagle Bus tours.
Have you been working in this field a long time?
I actually have just joined the staff of the Conservancy, so I came on as a staff member in early September here, but my background has been working in environmental education, so it's a slightly different role, but one I'm very excited about, and particularly with the Eagle program is my main focus at the moment, working with our volunteers and getting people engaged with the wildlife of our area.
So what kind of things do the volunteers do?
So our volunteers are trained. We actually have that training coming up if people are interested in learning more about volunteering. Saturday, December 7th, we host a training breakfast at the Inn at Lackawaxen. And they're just given all kinds of information about the history of eagles in our area, facts about eagles, you know, eagle biology, the best time to see them, you know, really any kind of question that somebody who would be visiting an eagle viewing blind would want to know. We give the volunteers all of that information so that they're very well equipped to go out and staff these blinds where they have viewing scopes and binoculars, and they're able to then assist our visitors who are coming and who want to learn more about eagles in the region.
So they're really helping visitors to be able to spot where the eagles might be.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yes, they're our front line of eagle watchers.
Very nice. Very good. All right. Well, tell folks once again when and where the presentations are taking place.
Sure. So Eagle Day is taking place at the Wallen Paul Pack Environmental Learning Center at 126 Lambert Lane in Hawley. It is Saturday, November 16th from 12 to 3:30 p.m., and it is a free event. No registration required.
Fantastic. Kate, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
That was Kate Hassman from the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, and Eagle Day starts in just a little while over in Hawley, Pennsylvania. You should have time to catch it, though. You're listening to the Here and There edition of Radio Chatskill. If you're interested in checking out one of the prettiest places in our listening area, take a ride and take a look at the barn quilts of Neversink. I'm talking to Dave Moore. I was looking at some information from the county recently, and they had a brochure about the barn quilts in the town of Neversink. And I guess that these barn quilts have been around for some time, but you know something about the origin of this.
Correct. Yes, this was a byproduct of the Neversink Renaissance beautification program, which the actual beautification program started in about 2000 through Sullivan Renaissance. And after we had completed a number of more gardening-type projects, we were looking for other ways to enhance the beauty of our town. And we had, this was in 2007, Barbara Purcell, who was a very active member of our Renaissance group, came up with the idea of putting painted barn quilt patterns on barns and other structures around the town of Neversink. So it was her kind of brainchild that started this process, and she read something about it in a town in Iowa where they'd done a similar kind of approach.
So this is almost kind of a variation on the, I guess you'd call them the hex signs that you sometimes see in Pennsylvania on sides
Correct.
Of barns, right?
Correct.
And how did you enlist everybody to go out and paint their barns?
Well, once she kind of helped us grasp the concept, and I think she first started by painting one with her daughter-in-law, which was then, it was actually the first one that we installed in the town of Neversink. That was an 8x8 panel that was placed on their barn. Once it became something that people could see and wrap their heads around, it quickly became a real, you know, exciting thing for people to get involved in. And one of the things that Barbara did was she would have painting sessions. We had some of them going at the hall at the Reformed Church and some at the hall at the First Aid Building. And they were in a position to allow us to keep our materials there. And people would come in and paint for a day and do a good deal of work and then come back another time and continue on. And actually, they were completing multiple quilts at the same time in those sessions with a number of people getting involved.
So these are kind of painted on signs rather than on the side of the barn itself.
Correct. They are either 4x4 panels or 8x8 panels that are, you know, first the pattern is applied and then framed and then installed on the barn itself. Or sometimes they're on sheds. They're on quite a variety of buildings within the town.
So that's probably...
there are actually 165 of them that are officially in our barn quilt guide, but they're actually more than that because other people have taken it upon themselves to, you know, paint their own and place them on their own structures too.
And that's how you get the variety of the quilt patterns, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, you know, people would kind of, first of all, look at what space am I trying to fill in terms of size, whether I'm looking at a larger structure that could handle a large 8x8 pattern or something smaller, like a shed that might only take a 4x4. And depending on the type of structure that it is, they might look for a certain pattern, either by the name of the pattern or the color combinations that were in the pattern. Those are all kind of things that people might consider. For example, Graves Woodworking has one called Carpenter's Wheel on it.
Oh, cool.
And the New York City Water Supply Building has one called Turban on it. Mm-hmm. Those are the actual patterns.
Yeah.
So
were there quilters involved with this project too?
Many of the people who were artists were also interested in quilting and in the quilting patterns as well. And, you know, they did research online or in books through a lot of different sources. And as we got into this, we soon learned that there were other places around the country in places like Ohio and West Virginia and other places like that that had ones that we could look at and see what they looked like and get ideas as well.
I wonder if anybody takes a trip, you know, from town to town to see these kind of projects.
Well, we certainly know that people are interested in the ones in the town of Neversink. I've fielded phone calls from quilting groups from other areas who wanted to come and, you know, follow the trail and examine the quilts. And it's kind of a fun way to see the setting, because it is right there in the foothills of the Catskills, so it's beautiful rolling hills. And the thing that I think is really neat is that the process of putting these quilts up helped to provide an incentive for some barn owners to enhance their buildings by either painting them or cleaning up the brush around them and making them more presentable. So it added to the kind of the secondary gain of the beauty of the whole concept.
It was kind of a spur to other beautification efforts.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah,
yep.
the kind of the way to explore the setting was really what I had in mind when I first reached out to the folks in Neversink, and it seems as though there's a number of kind of legs of the tour that you can do, different drives.
Right. There are three different tours that exist that are depicted in the tricolor brochure that was developed. You know, some are a little bit more concentrated, and so they're not as long. The one that is right around the village of Grahamsville is a little bit of a shorter route, so that wouldn't take quite as long to drive, while there's another one that goes from Neversink past the Neversink Reservoir, goes around the reservoir up to Willowemonk, and then through Claryville, and then returns back toward Neversink area. So that one is a much longer tour, but has quite a number of quilts on it as well that people can look out for.
So it kind of gives you a direction and a route if you're kind of looking to go out and explore the area. You can follow
Correct.
One of these. So now I believe that the town of Neversink has these brochures on hand. Is it also available online, do you know?
Yes, you can find it online at the townofneversink.org. There's a separate barn quilt trail link that you'll find there. And, you know, it is handy to have the little brochure, though, to be able to put it in hand and be able to follow the route as you're driving, because
mm-hmm.
There might be some areas where you, unless you downloaded it or something ahead of time, you probably lose some signal in some of the mountain or more mountainous areas.
Sure. So if you if you're on this trail, are there other high points of either buildings or natural geography that you would suggest people look out for?
Oh, sure. Just within the village of Grahamsville, the Time in the Valleys Museum is a great destination.
Mm-hmm.
The Daniel Pierce Library, both, you know, provide some very, you know, nice things to stop and visit and see. You'll be passing both the Rondout and Neversink Reservoirs. The Rondout Reservoir has a nice eagle watch there. You'll also be passing nearby the Red Hill Fire Tower, a historical site. The Claryville Tannery is something you'd see in Claryville. And just the natural beauty of driving through the hills and the mountains are really a great bonus for this particular trip.
Pretty spectacular this time of year, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Taking advantage of the fall colors is a good thing.
Yep. So that's a wonderful way to get out and see some of the some of the countryside, particularly for people for whom Claryville and Neversink and that neighborhood is new territory.
Yeah, it's not exactly on the direct route to too many places, so you know it kind of brings you out to see these quilts, but then beyond that, the natural beauty that's out there in the mountains.
Nice, Dave. Any other tips for travelers?
I'd say pack a picnic lunch. There are some nice venues to stop and eat as well in Neversink and Grahamsville, and up in Claryville is a new brewery up there, so there are a couple little stops along the way if you're wanting to grab a bite to eat as well.
Fantastic.
So that's something you could also consider.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for telling us about the Barn Quilt of Neversink. Talking to Dave Moore, who was involved in the initial project. Thanks
so
much, Dave. Good to talk to you. Take
care.
The Barn Quilt brochure lays out three different tours. The red tour ranges from Neversink to Willowemonk and beyond. The yellow tour is south of Grahamsville, and the green tour is to the north. You can find the brochure on the Town of Neversink website. Click on the icon of the covered bridge on the welcome page. And if you go, let me know how you liked it. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, community radio for the Catskills, Delaware River Valley, and Northeast Pennsylvania. Let's see what's going on. On Radio Chatskill this week, I'll take you here and there in the listening area, looking at places to go and things to do. We'll check in on Eagle Day, happening Saturday at the Wall and Paw Pack Environmental Center. And we'll take a ride around Neversink to check out the barn quilts. And we'll climb up into the Gunks to visit the hamlet of Craigsmore. I'm Barb Demarest. Join me this Saturday at 10 for Radio Chatskill on WJFF. Well, happily you've done so.
WJFF's music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and this amazing event, it only happens because people like you donate musical items that we can sell. We've got some great records for the bargain bins already, but what we really need now are those high-quality items. Records in top-notch condition, working stereos and turntables, music collectibles for our silent auction, and any working instrument. If you had something like that, it could really help us out. So please, donate to the music sale today.
Welcome back to WJFF Radio, and I'm your host, Barb Demarest. This is a great time of year to explore the towns that perhaps you haven't had a chance to see for yourself, but you've heard about. I had the chance a couple of years ago to visit Craigsmore, and I was very impressed by the beauty of the place. Last week, I went back again to see more of the town and talk to some of the people who know it well. It's a little hamlet of less than 500 people in the town of Wawasing, up way up in the Shangums, or Gunks as they're known, and most of the visitors there are drawn to the area by hiking. So let's start there.
What's the geology like here?
It's really what gives the place its, you know, beauty and its landforms. There's the rock that most people think of when they think of the Shawangunks is the white conglomerate that you can see from the valley. It's an old delta, kind of like where the Mississippi River comes into the Gulf of Mexico. And it deposited quartzite into a sand. That hardened over time, and when the Taconic mountains were being formed, east of here, tilted it straight up on its edge. And then what really sculpted it was the Ice Age, 12 to 15,000 years ago, and the glaciers really shaped the rock. But the rock's, you know, very hard. The quartz is one of the hardest substances on Earth, so it's a really durable, erosion-resistant rock, and sits on top of a shale cap that's about a half mile thick.
What brings people specifically to Sam's Point?
I think it is the geology. The two places that people like to visit the most at Sam's Point are Sam's Point itself, mm-hmm. which is it's basically the highest promontory in the Shawangunk Range. There's a couple of little bumps that are up higher, but Sam's Point has a road going to it, so it's easy to get to. Mm-hmm. And so there's a spectacular view up there on a clear day. You can see about five states.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And that's definitely, that's part of the geology. And then the other really popular place to visit is the ice caves. Mm-hmm. And that's a series of crevices and caves, about a half mile long trail, which it's called the ice caves because it holds ice until July or so.
Wow.
And then it starts icing up again in November, usually.
And that's something that you just have guided hikes to, right? That's not something...
Oh, no, that's open to the public.
Oh, it is.
Whenever it's safe enough to allow people in there. Mm-hmm. So when we pay attention to the state of the ice, when the ice melts out enough. And, I think it's one thing to note about geology, the Shawangunks, Sam's Point area specifically, but part of it, but also the Shawangunks by connection, are designated by the National Park Service as a national natural landmark.
Hmm.
And that is really for the largest collection of talus and crevice caves in the world. So that's what the ice caves at Sam's Point are part of the talus cave network. But the talus caves are really all over the range. Usually very difficult to get to or through, but the ice caves here at Sam's Point, we've installed a solar powered lighting system in the dark sections, boardwalks over the sections where it's difficult to walk, installed ladders, so it makes it something that it's a challenging trail, but you can get through it without needing any kind of caving equipment or lights or anything. So it's the one place where the crevice caves are easily accessible to the public.
So for an experienced hiker, how long a hike is that to the ice caves?
It takes most people about 2 hours from the parking area where the visitor center is, mm-hmm. at Sam's Point to get to the ice caves, through them and back. So it's not a really difficult long walk or anything. So families enjoy it, mm-hmm. Kids
Great.
Kids can
Great.
Do it, yeah.
So what kind of programs does the park run, and particularly coming up over the next couple months?
Every weekend we run programs for the public, and some of them are drop-in programs. Some of them you have to register for ahead of time. You know, we do at least two or three programs a month, and sometimes as many as 10 or 12 programs a month, yeah.
So is there anything specific for when winter sets in?
Well, yeah. In wintertime, where this place is, as anybody who lives in Cragsmore will tell you, the high elevation makes it, it's always more wintry up here than it is anywhere else. It's kind of like being on the top of a Catskills mountain, but there's a community up here. So when it's raining in Ellenville, it's usually snowing up here.
Okay. What's the difference in elevation between, say, Ellenville and where we are now?
About 1,700 feet.
Wow.
So it's a pretty you probably noticed that driving up here. It's a pretty big climb coming up here.
Much easier in a car than a horse.
yeah, for sure. It's so we, you know, the park, a good time to visit the park is in the winter, assuming people are properly prepared with the right kind of clothing, because it is a harsh winter environment. But it's also a winter wonderland up here. So one of the programs that we run every weekend in winter, we run them on Saturdays, snow allowing, is like it's a drop-in learn to snowshoe and discounted rental. So folks can come up here, get fitted with snowshoes. A ranger or staff person will spend time with them, take them on a short walk to use this to teach them how to use the snowshoes and show them around the visitor center area. And then the folks can continue to keep the snowshoes for the rest of the day and snowshoe around the park. That's a program that I think people would really enjoy. It's a unique thing.
When does that usually get started? I mean, you were saying...
Typically December.
December, yeah. Okay.
And folks can either look at that website, nysparks.com, or give us a call at the park anytime.
To see if there's any snow to speak of.
Yeah, and I give you the phone number, because it's a good time to do that.
Sure.
Yeah, so the best way to reach the park by phone is 845-647-7989.
So, as somebody who knows this park inside and out, what's your favorite things to do here?
I really like being up on the plateau with the dwarf pitch pines, that's probably the unique ecosystem. The reason this place is an Article 20 Park Preserve is that we have this high altitude dwarf pitch pine barrens, to me that's exceptional. It's just white rock, blueberries, and these little pitch pines that look like bonsai trees over the place.
Okay.
And, 3,000 acres of that up here. So
I'm thinking that that's something of what I saw in Acadia.
Yes, you will find, you find patches of pitch pine at high elevation throughout the Northeast.
Okay.
Most of your dwarf pitch pine barrens occur at sea level on sand in places like Nantucket, Long Island. New Jersey is famous for its pine barrens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rather than just being a patchy little forest on a summit, this is a large 3,000 acre forest.
Wow.
But really what's unique about it is it's growing on bedrock at 2,000 feet instead of on sand at sea level like it is in the coastal areas.
Right. So just to back up a little bit, the Schwangunks, the Schwangunks.
Don't worry, everybody has trouble saying that.
You were saying before that sometimes people think it's part of the Catskills, but it really is its own range.
Yeah, that's right. It's the Schwangunks, or what a lot of people call it, the Gunks, just because it's a lot
easier to say.
And that happens with a lot of the names up here. There's a lot of Dutch and Lenape names, So people shorten them and nickname them.
Right.
The Schwangunks is geologically unique from the Catskills. Here in New York State, the Schwangunk range straddles the Rondout Valley and the Wallkill Valley to the east, the Rondout Valley to the west. And they run down to the New Jersey state line.
Now, who was Sam of Sam's Point? Do we know?
Yeah, So the place is named after Sam Gonzalez, who was a Portuguese settler who was here in this area. He was a trapper, subsistence farmer, and you can find references to the Gonzalez family, like kind of all through this part of the Hudson Valley, mm-hmm. and down around Newburgh and such. Mm-hmm. But he was here right at the time when the English were taking over from the Dutch, okay. and he signed on to work as a scout. He signed on to work as a scout for the English soldiers, and the natives who lived here, the Lenape, didn't like that, so they decided to kill him. And he was up hunting on the plateau here, and he got cornered by a Lenape war party and fled to the edge of the cliffs, and facing, you know, torture and death, he jumped off the cliff and kind of miraculously fell through some oak trees or something and survived the fall. And the Lenape were so impressed with his bravery that they gave him and his family a pass and let him continue to live here.
Okay.
And that's, you know, I'm not sure of the exact words for it. It's a legend, but it has enough cross-references that some story like that actually happened.
So maybe a little embellished, but...
yeah, maybe he didn't jump off the 80-foot part of the cliff. Maybe he jumped off the 20-foot part of the cliff or something, but... yeah, that's what the place is named after.
Mm-hmm. Besides the parks, what other things do you think are interesting in this general area?
Cragsmoor?
Yeah.
You know, I think the history of this place as an art colony, mm-hmm. Looking at the paintings and the painters that summered here, mm-hmm. you know, that was really where a lot of the Hudson River School painters started. So that the rich art culture of the place, there's mm-hmm. still, the community still has a lot of practicing artists mm-hmm. Here. And that's another thing we've tried to tie into by opening a gallery here at the Visitor Center at Sam's Point. So folks can check that on the website. We usually have local artists displaying work here mm-hmm. in our gallery. Mm-hmm. But that art history is phenomenal. The architecture... of the some of the buildings around here, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. The history of the mountain houses, and the other thing that I think is fascinating is the berry picker culture, which was that was kind of centered here around Sam's Point. This place was underneath the pitch pines is basically the ground cover is all blueberries and huckleberries.
Okay.
And
so when you say the berry picker culture, what does that mean?
So from basically when the railroad got put in the O&W Railroad came up through the Rondout Valley, people had always, there's always been a huge amount of blueberries and huckleberries mm-hmm. here. And kind of local people would pick them, and some of them would sell them to local the mountain houses and bakeries and stuff. But what happened in the 1870s or so, they were able to get the berries quickly to market.
Oh.
So this interesting culture of seasonal berry pickers, and a lot of it was local families from mm-hmm. Ellenville, Pine Bush, Walker Valley. They would move up onto the mountain during the berry seasons. I think the berry picking season started late June and went through August.
Mm-hmm.
And right here at Sam's Point, you know, there's actually a little encampment which had in its heyday had about 35 or 40 little blueberry picker shacks, and some of the berry pickers, would become middlemen, and they would. People would take their blueberries to them, and they would form. They built these little stores, mm-hmm. and they would trade, groceries and liquor for the berry pickers to trade in for their berries.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a singing camping culture, and it's something we interpret here at the Visitor Center. We have some videos in the Nature Center that are interviews with the old berry pickers, and went strong until. They invented the commercial blueberries in the Pine Barrens at White's Bog, New Jersey. I think Ocean Spray, the cranberry people, were mm-hmm. the first ones to get that going. And mm-hmm. Those are larger, not as good tasting, easier to harvest. And I mean, people still pick blueberries, and many of the, you know, in terms of Cragsmoor, many of the folks that have lived up here multi-generationally are descendants of berry pickers.
What else should we tell listeners about?
You know, I think if folks want to visit any of the managed lands in the Shawangunks at Mohonk or Minnewaska, you just have to be aware that it's an incredibly popular place, and people should really try and come on a weekday, because frequently on weekends, every parking lot on the mountain, we're turning cars away because we don't have enough. We don't really have enough capacity, and also, you know, we try to manage the place so it doesn't get completely overrun with people.
Sure.
So if you're stuck with coming on a weekend, in spring, summer, or fall, you should try and arrive before 10 a.m. Very much so. And if you can come on weekdays, that's even better. And wintertime is very, there's no problems getting into the park if folks enjoy winter recreation. Mm-hmm. Sam's Point has snowshoeing and backcountry skiing, but Minnewaska, the Minnewaska section of the park, when snow is good, we groom it, and we have some of the best cross-country skiing in the Northeast. We have great grooming crew, and the carriage roads that I spoke about before make just for fantastic cross-country skiing.
Yeah. Great. Hank, thanks so much for telling me about Sam's Point and the region.
Oh, sure. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Good, good. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Hank Alicandri, the park director for Sam's Point Preserve of Minnewaska State Park. For more information, you can search online for Minnewaska State Park, Sam's Point area, and the phone number, as Hank gave it, was 845-647-7989 for any questions. The Visitor Center opens at 9 a.m. each day, and be sure to check out the link to the real-time weather at Sam's Point from parks.ny.gov. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk to resident Mary Sokoloff about the history and nature of the community. But first, let's take a short break. It's up to 28 degrees here in Jeffersonville, going to a high of 33 today. And you're listening to Radio Chatskill. This is WJFF Public Radio for Sullivan County, the Catskills, and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Next time on the New York Philharmonic This Week, Paul Lewis makes his subscription debut as soloist in the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Brahms. Also on the program, the Symphony No. 2 by Robert Schumann. I'm Alec Baldwin. I hope you'll enjoy this music with me as Christoph von Dohnanyi conducts the New York Philharmonic This Week.
Tuesday at noon on WJFF.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm your host, Barb Demarest, and this is the Here and There edition. We're looking at the hamlet of Cragsmoor, which is high up in the Shawangunks, not far from Ellenville. If you go to Sam's Point, don't neglect to take some time to look around the hamlet. It's a historic summer artist community, and quite interesting in its own right. I talked to longtime resident and Historical Society president Mary Sokoloff about the nature of the community.
How did Cragsmoor get settled as a town? How did there come to be a town way up here on the top of the mountain?
Well, originally people were up here. They were trapping. And it was actually a pretty poor community, a very poor farming community, because the farming is not easy. We have a very short season and rocky soil. But the community, you know, people came up from the valley, saw that there was property to be had, and they settled it and tried to make a living on it, doing whatever they could at the time.
So after the farm, those initial farmers, then how did the population grow?
Well, a wealthy woman from Newport, Rhode Island, Mrs. Eliza Hartshorne, came to visit a relative in Ellenville, New York, and came up the mountain and actually was thrown from a wagon and twisted her ankle. So she ended up having to recover in Cragsmoor.
So she had to stick around for a while.
So she had to stick around for a while. And the mountain charmed her, as it does many people. It has beautiful vistas, and in the summer it was absolutely lovely. She ended up buying quite a bit of property and inviting some friends up, and they turned out to be artists, intellectuals, and as she was building different homes around, they wanted to build summer homes as well. So it was primarily a summer community for them. They commuted up from Ellenville in horse and carriage and would spend the whole summer here.
And Ellenville was on one of the rail lines, wasn't it?
It was on the rail line and on the canal line prior to that.
Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of well-known artists and writers here as well?
Mostly artists.
Okay.
But they also invited their friends who were writers and other types of intellectuals and well-to-do friends from New York City.
So is that kind of sense of the community still one that pertains today? Do you think that there's, you know, that kind of artistic sensibility in many of the residents?
I do think so. The community is, I would guess, about 50% weekenders or summer people.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to draw a lot of artists, a lot of artistic people, writers, filmmakers. It's really surprising the percentage of art-influenced and art, you know, enthusiasts that live here.
Well, it's really a spectacular view and scenery, so it's hard to imagine that, you know, even the most untalented individual, myself, for instance, you know, might decide that, you know, it's time to start taking up watercolors or something.
Right. Well, the vistas are amazing. And if you look at some of the old art, especially someone like Charles Courtney Curran, mm-hmm. who did vistas off the mountaintops mm-hmm. that were spectacular with beautiful woman and flowing dresses and clouds drifting across. But it also had other artists such as Milton Resnick, who had quite a different style of art. Mm-hmm. He was obviously a later artist, but, you know, quite abstract.
Is there a particular architectural style that that you'd see around here?
Well, most of the old houses up here were actually built by Frederick Dellenbaugh, who was a famous explorer. He went with Powell and explored the West. He actually went to the Arctic as an explorer when he was in his teens,
wow.
which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
He developed the Explorers Club in New York City, and he also was a self-taught architect and artist, and he built most of the homes up here during that time.
So kind of a shingle and fieldstone style?
Yes, and it's actually kind of funny because people talk about the homes built with the stairs that go to nowhere because he actually salvaged a lot of the building materials from derelict buildings or buildings being torn down in New York City at different places and imported them.
So what would you say are some of the more notable buildings here in the community?
Well, the library,
mm-hmm.
which we're sitting in right now,
yeah.
is a lovely, extraordinary building. There's the old stone church, which is beautiful and really inspiring to artists. And every weekend, people are up there taking pictures of the stone church and the views behind it.
Yeah, it's really kind of just, you know, a vast expanse mm-hmm. behind the church.
Yes, it's lovely. The Historical Society. And we also have, you know, Sam's Point, which is really close, which is a great state park, mm-hmm. including many vistas, if you walk up there.
Now, what was the era of the Craigsmore Inn?
The Craigsmore Inn was really popular. It was started at the turn of the century. It was a small inn called the Wayback? Yes. But it was actually bought by Auster Sturtevant, who developed it into the inn that it was. It was very popular. You look at our little hamlet now, which is, except for a really vibrant community, doesn't have a lot of commercial enterprises, really has none. At that time, the inn was very popular. There were boarding houses all over the community. Mm-hmm. There was a theater that was renowned and advertised in New York City, mm-hmm. had people coming up. We had a casino. We had
wow.
restaurants. it's hard to believe because those things are not here anymore.
Right.
And unfortunately, the inn had to be torn down. It was derelict at the end.
I was going to say, what happened to all those
institutions? They just went defunct. People, you know, stopped using them. The It's a shame about the inn, but it's, you know, popularity shifted mm-hmm. and people stopped coming up here mm-hmm. as like, you know, to stay for this, basically the summers, except for people who have bought their houses here now and do that. So
is the population changing at all these days? Is there more summer people, influx, outflow?
I would say that most of the people buying homes up here now mm-hmm. are weekend people. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it seems like the majority of them are from Brooklyn. Hmm. Why? I'm not sure.
So being used as a summer and weekend, but I guess it was always some of that tradition.
It always was. Right. Most of the homes up here, the historic homes, were built as summer homes. Mm-hmm. So people actually had to insulate them when they bought them, mm-hmm. you know, put furnaces in them. And
is it kind of severe up here?
It's not pleasant sometimes in the winter, I will say. The weather is severe. It has a little microclimate, which uh-huh. is a lot colder than the surrounding valley.
Sure. And do you get lots of, you know, sort of spectacular storms at other times of year as well?
We do. We do. And the fact, you know, the vistas, which are so beautiful in the summer, provide no wind breaks. Mm-hmm. So it's windy and we get a lot of nor'easters and it's, you know, sometimes a little severe.
Now, what about the work of the Historical Society? What is that all about?
Well, the Historical Society was founded basically to research Cragsmoor and to provide education about the history of Cragsmoor to the community and anyone really interested.
And you run some programs?
We do run some programs. We're not open as a museum, but we do have lectures. We had one recently about Native American archaeological sites on the Shamgam Ridge. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have one this summer about the culture of Native Americans that lived on the ridge and traveled through it. Mm-hmm. We've done art shows, you know, quite a few different types of lectures mm-hmm. and events.
So how did you come to live here? Have you always lived in Cragsmoor?
Well, we bought our house in 1990. And as many other people do, we were living in New York City then. Mm-hmm. We're looking for a weekend home. We had rented houses in the area and found Cragsmoor. We had always heard about Cragsmoor, but had mm-hmm. never really seen it. And as soon as we saw it, we knew this was the spot. You know, it was beautiful. People were friendly. It's an incredibly vibrant community with a lot of social events happening, and you can participate or not as you mm-hmm. would like.
So are you full-time now?
I am full-time now, yes.
So talk about that community aspect of things. What do people kind of gather around? I'm assuming the library is one of those things.
The library is a very vital part of this. Mm-hmm. The Historical Society. Mm-hmm. We have a state park right next door. We have our Cragsmoor Association and Cragsmoor Conservancy. And their functions are basically geared around the environment. Mm-hmm. We have the Friends of the Stone Church, which protect the church. And people have events all throughout the summer. Every weekend is full, really.
Wow. So the Conservancy basically does some land preservation in the area? Is that correct?
That is correct. They do land preservation. Mm-hmm. And the Cragsmoor Association was founded to actually save Bear Hill, which is a vista at the end, it's the northwest end of Cragsmoor, mm-hmm. that was going to at one point be developed into house tracts and condos. Mm-hmm. And the community got together, donated the money to buy it. Donated to the library mm-hmm. to preserve for everyone's use.
An extensive hiking area, or is that more just an outlook?
It's a small hiking area. It's mm-hmm. not extensive, mm-hmm. and it's an outlook.
What would you like to see for the future of Cragsmoor?
Well, I would like to see it, you know, kept environmentally beautiful without, you know, a lot of development, which I think the community as a whole feels the same way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, keep on with the social events, historical events, all of the different things that makes Cragsmoor what it is, which is a community of people that care about each other and like to participate and, you know, friendly place to be.
That was Mary Sokolov of the Cragsmoor Historical Society. As Mary said, there aren't a lot of public facilities in Cragsmoor besides the parks, but the two spots that everyone will recommend, justifiably so, are the Stone Church and the library. The Stone Church is on Henry Street, and it's good signage to find your way to it. If you visit, be sure and walk around the back to see the expansive views of the valley. The annual Festival of Lessons and Carols, which is scheduled this year for Saturday, December 21st at 5 p.m., is sure to be memorable. The other public building that's widely recommended is the charming Cragsmoor Public Library. I got to speak to the library director and some trustees, and they'll introduce themselves.
I'm Donna Christie. I'm president of the Cragsmoor Free Library.
I'm Nancy Crow. I'm the director of the library.
I'm Bayat Curl. I was on the board.
And we're here in the Cragsmoor Library, which is a really unique place. Nancy, can you talk a little bit about what this library looks like?
What it looks like?
Yeah.
Well, it was opened July 9th, 1925. The columns are chestnut, which are no longer in existence. The stained glass windows were commissioned from Lamb Studio in New York. And the red bin in the fireplace was also commissioned at the same time.
And beside two floors of stacks with kind of a walkway around the upper, there's also a great deal of art in here.
Artwork is all from artists that have either lived here or had summer homes here, mm-hmm. from the 1800s to present day.
Yeah, I mean, basically what this represents are the artists that came here that became the Cragsmoor Colony that happened in the turn of the century, which comes after Hudson River Valley School. Mm-hmm. That was like pre-20th century. It was established by Innes Jr., which is this painting. He bought these pillars, and then Dellenbaugh was... the person who he gave the land, and he also designed and had this building built.
And it was built all by local people.
Local people, yeah.
Local craftspeople.
The goldsmiths. Actually, we have a receipt of the cost of the library in the gallery there.
What did it cost?
A little over $5,000.
Wow. What else would you like to tell listeners about the town and the area?
Well, the library is open Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So please come by. Even if you're not looking for a book or a DVD, come by and just visit the library. And
see the architecture and the artwork.
Right. And then take a spin around the top of the mountain.
Good, good.
What would I say? Well, I can give you the history of the library.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you the history of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
If you lost your dog, we can help you find it. If you need a Band-Aid, I have that. We do. I can even give you coffee and tea. So the library loves to have people come visit, and we love visitors.
Fantastic.
Plus, we have a small gallery that just got established maybe about a half a year ago, and it represents the artwork that comes from our collection, because there's a lot more artwork than just what you see. So what I did is I established that space back there, and I curate the shows.
Beautiful, beautiful.
So people can see the collection.
Mm-hmm.
Plus what I did is I created a website for the entire community, including the library, and even presently the entire collection is online.
Can you give us that website?
It's cragsmoorfreelibrary.info.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about this gorgeous community and wonderful building here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming. Good.
You're thank welcome.
You.
Thank you.
Good.
Thanks so much. Reminder to all of our listeners, thank you so much for your participation in the recent pledge drive. Thanks to our guests today, Kate Hausman from the Delaware Highlands Conservancy, Dave Moore of the Never Seeing Barn Quilts, and Hank Alicandri from Sam's Point, Mary Sokoloff from the Historical Society, and Nancy Crum, Donna Christie, and Bayat Curl from the Library. I'll be visiting some other communities in the region and would love your recommendations on places to go and things to do. I'm Barb Demarest, and thanks for listening to Radio Chatskill today. And we'll be going to Farm and Country in just a moment.
Support comes from listeners and from the Livingston Manor Chamber of Commerce, your destination for dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Mountains, livingstonmanor.org.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley, redcottageinc.com.
It's up to 28 degrees. This is WJFF in Jeffersonville and W233AH in Monticello.
Support comes from you and from Van Gorder's Furniture, featuring Lodge and Adirondack styles, as well as rustic collections with showrooms at Lake Wallenpaupack, downtown Honesdale, and Milford, Pennsylvania. Van Gorder's Furniture brings the outdoors